William and the Spy. The members of William's family were having their annual holiday by the sea. They were staying in the boarding house in which they generally stayed. The Browns chose it because it did not object to William. It was not enough for the Browns to go to a boarding house that did not object to children. It had to be one that did not object to William. This boarding house took it as the natural course of things that William's crabs should make their home in the hatstand drawer, and that William himself should leave a trail of sand and shells and jellyfish wherever he went. One evening after supper, William decided to visit the drawing room. He'd never patronised the drawing room before, and the novelty of the situation rather intrigued him. There was an old lady asleep in an armchair by the fireplace. On the other side of the fireplace sat another lady, tall and thin and middle-aged, engaged upon a piece of crochet work and wearing a pair of pince-nez balanced on the very end of her nose. Between her and the sleeping old lady was a circle of other ladies, all middle-aged and thin and spectacled, and engaged upon needlework. The one by the fireplace was talking. She had lived an utterly uneventful life and had never had anything to talk about till the war came. She hadn't yet realised that most people had stopped talking about the war years ago.
"Of course," she was saying, "the country had been full of their spies for years before the war began. They'd come over as tourists or students or even professors. And they'd pass as Englishmen anywhere, you know. They're such clever linguists. And they'd each take a tiny bit of the coastline and study it till they knew every inch of it. Riddled with spies, the country was, and what they've done once, they can do again."
William drank in her words. He'd never heard anything like this before. Most thrilling of all was, "And what they've done once, they can do again." He crept quietly out of the room. Standing in the hall was an elderly man with a short white beard talking to the proprietress. He held a suitcase in his hand and had evidently just arrived. He was saying,
"I'm a geologist, you know. I've come here to study this part of the coast."
And then, of course, William knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was a spy who had come over to prepare for the next war.
"What's a geologist?" William asked his mother next morning.
"A man who studies rocks," she said.
"Huh, that's a jolly easy way to do it."
"What are you talking about?" said his mother.
Professor Summerton was not at all surprised to find himself dogged throughout the morning by a small boy. He had learnt that wherever one was and whatever one was doing, small boys always hung about to watch and, if possible, annoy one. But this small boy was rather odd in his behaviour. For instance, one could see nothing at all of his face as he kept his cap pulled down and his coat collar turned up, and he followed one in an extraordinary fashion, sidling along by the rocks. The professor returned to the boarding house early for lunch, only to discover to his annoyance that he'd lost the sheet of paper on which he'd been making his shorthand notes. At that very moment, William was entering a hollow in the rocks with elaborate precaution, gazing round on all sides to see that the coast was clear, and handing the sheet of paper to his imaginary Secret Service chief. "Here's his code, what I've got at deadly peril," he was saying. "If he'd seen me, he'd have killed me. He's got a special water pistol in his pocket made to look like a fountain pen, and I bet if he'd seen me, I'd be dead by now." The chief read the paper with many a low whistle and exclamation of "Gosh!" He immediately promoted William to be second in command.
"When you hear of me being killed by criminals," said the chief, "what I'm likely to be any minute, you just carry on here. Seems to me you're the bravest man I've ever come across. Next to me, of course."
William was well satisfied by his morning's work. The professor was less satisfied. After lunch, he went out to the rocks and set to work again. He had a tape measure and a little hammer, and he worked hard, stopping every now and then to make notes or to add to the contours of a rough map that he was making. Again, that boy was there, peering at him between the buttonholes of his coat, which was pulled up till the collar was on a level with the top of his head.
crawling after him on hands and knees, watching him from inadequate hiding places among the rocks, sidling around him in a way that distracted the professor indescribably. And then, when he reached the boarding house for tea, he found that he'd lost the map that contained the results of his afternoon's work. William, meanwhile, was seated in the hollow among the rocks. He'd grown tired of his chief and had had him killed by criminals. He was holding a meeting of the other Secret Service men and telling them that he was now in sole charge. He told them that he had got both the code and the map from the spy and asked how they'd been getting on. They had, of course, no results to show him, and he was very stern with them. The professor set out the next morning with a firm determination. He was sure that he would never have lost those papers if it hadn't been for that boy's distracting his attention by his antics. So today he went a longer way down the coast than usual. William, however, followed him as before, slipping from rock to rock. William was blissfully unaware that his quarry had even caught a glimpse of him. It was therefore an unpleasant surprise when, as he was engaged on watching his victim on hands and knees from the shadow of a rock, his victim turned on him savagely and said, "I've had enough of your monkey tricks, my boy. Clear off and be quick about it." William rose to his feet with dignity. He thought it best now to reveal himself in his true colours.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, I bet you'd like me to clear off. I bet you don't know who I am."
"Well, who are you, then?" said the professor irritably.
"I know all about you," said William darkly. "I know what you're doing and where you've come from, and I've got your code, so it's no use trying to send any secret messages. And my men are all surrounding you, so it's no use trying to escape."
"Clear off!" roared the professor angrily. "And don't give me any more of your impudence." He made a threatening gesture with his hammer. "Clear off!"
William lost no time in clearing off. He told himself, when he reached the promenade, that his life was of too great value to his country for him to risk it unduly. He stood, wondering what to do. There was no doubt at all that the man was a spy and that it was his duty to bring him to justice. He looked about him. Along the promenade, a policeman was walking with slow and measured tread.
That was the best thing to do, of course. Tell a policeman about it and leave him to catch the spy and put him in prison. He ran after the policeman.
Please, there's a spy down on the beach. He's been measuring it out and making a map ready for the next war. You'll catch him if you're quick."
The policeman looked down at him, unamused.
"Now, my lad, don't try any of your funny work on me, because I haven't time for it."
And he continued on his way. Disconcerted, William stood doubtfully on the pavement. The responsibility of bringing his spy to justice was beginning to weigh heavily upon his spirit. He wandered slowly back onto the beach, climbed into an unattended boat, and sat there thinking. As he scowled out over the sea, his head between his hands, he uttered his famous sardonic laugh.
Ha! He knew why they wouldn't believe him. They thought of him as a child. They'd no idea what he really was. If he could get a grown-up to see what the spy was doing, it'd be all right. The policeman would believe a grown-up.
They always believed grown-ups. "Now then," said a voice behind him, "nip out of this and look sharp."
William turned. The boatman to whom the boat belonged had come upon him unawares. He was a large man with a red face and a twinkle in his eye that belied his fierce voice.
"Less, of course," he went on with obvious sarcasm, "you're wanting a sail and willing to pay for it."
And then suddenly the idea came to William. Here was his witness, the grown-up who should catch the spy red-handed and give him over to the police. The spy would be keeping a lookout upon the land, of course, but he worked with his back to the sea, and he wouldn't be prepared for anyone coming upon him from that quarter.
"If you found a spy spying," said William, "would you give him up to the police?"
"Oh, you bet," said the man, winking at the breaker for want of anything else to wink at. "Why, I've caught dozens of them in my time."
William felt in his pocket. There reposed in it a sixpence that his father had given him that morning.
Yes, I'll have a sail," said William. "A sixpenny one, please." "How far do you think you'll get for sixpence?" said the man scornfully. "I'll get as far as I want to get," said William, "and I'll jolly well show you something that you didn't know was there."
There seemed to be no other prospective customer in sight, so the man good-naturedly pushed off his boat and jumped into it.
"Well, where do you want to go?"
"Keep close along the coast," said William. "It's just round that big rock, the bit you can't see from here." William was living for the moment when they should steal upon the spy from behind and catch him engaged upon his nefarious work. Then there was that next and just as thrilling moment to think about, when the burly boatman should hand the spy over to the police and William should tell how he had shadowed him and finally caught him.
"Round this here point, did you say?" asked the boatman.
"Yes."
"Oh, you can't land there, you know. Now it's high tide."
At that moment they rounded the point, and there, clinging in terror to the rocks, waist-high in water, was the Professor. As soon as he saw William and the boat, he gave a shout of joy.
"My rescuer!" he cried. "My noble rescuer!"
It was the next day. William was walking along the sea coast to the line of rocks beyond the beach. He'd spent last evening in a blaze of glory. The Professor had told the story eloquently to everyone in the boarding house.
"This boy was playing about near me while I was working, and I sent him away, because it worries me to have boys playing about near me when I'm working. He went away, and later on he noticed that I had not returned. And knowing that it would be high tide, and that the rocks where I'd been working would be covered, a fact that I had foolishly omitted to ascertain, the brave boy quietly hired a boat to come to my rescue. He saved my life."
William, who was beginning to have a dim suspicion that the Professor was not a spy after all, saw no reason to contradict the story. If the notoriety of having captured a dangerous spy were denied one, that of having rescued a celebrated professor of geology was better than nothing. He received the plaudits of the boarding house with modest nonchalance.
Oh, that's nothing. No, nothing. I'd do that for anyone, any time. Saving a person from drowning's nothing."
To mark his gratitude, the Professor gave William's mother £5 to add to William's post office savings account. William thanked him perfunctorily. William looked upon his post office savings account as a deliberate scheme of his parents to divert from him any money that might come his way. But it was now the next morning, and everyone, William included, was beginning to forget that he'd saved the Professor from a watery grave the day before. William was tired of being a Secret Service agent. He had decided to be a spy. He was an English spy in a foreign land. He had a tape measure stolen from his mother's work bag and a piece of stick to represent a hammer. With them, he measured and tapped the rocks, stopping occasionally to scrawl hieroglyphics on a piece of paper. Sometimes imaginary natives of the place would pass, and William would talk to them volubly in their own language, explaining that he was a professor of geology. He brought all the foreign words he knew into these conversations.
"Hic, hic, hoc," he would say. "Je suis, tu es, il est. Mensam, 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 la plume de ma tante, dominus, domine, dominum."
After a short conversation of this sort, the imagined foreigners would pass on their way, completely deceived, and William would return to his tapping and measuring. He was a spy. He was perfectly happy.